In late 2017, in the name of zero tolerance, President Donald Trump introduced a policy of separating parents and children who crossed the southern border and requested asylum in the United States. In all, 5,500 children were taken from their parents, and many were held in detention facilities, some of which had been constructed by the Obama administration. Over 1,000 children are still unaccounted for by the federal government. The program ended in 2018, but only after massive public outcry. The zero tolerance policy is the subject of Separated, a new documentary by Academy Award winner Errol Morris. Separated has aired on MSNBC and will be available for streaming on December 17th. I talked with Morris and journalist Jacob Soboroff, whose book on the controversy inspired the film. We discuss how family separation became policy and whether it acted as a deterrent. America's long and ambivalent relationship with legal and illegal immigration. Here is the Reason interview with Errol Morris and Jacob Soboroff.
Every day there are children who enter the United States unaccompanied by a parent or legal guardian. And those children require protection and care to find a family member of theirs in the United States who can take care of them. Family separation, though, was not about unaccompanied children. It was about accompanied children. It was about children with their families. And the unaccompanied children program, which I worked in, was essentially hijacked for a purpose for which it was never intended nor authorized in law. It was a program designed to be a child protection program for children who entered the United States without parents. And it was instead used as a tool to take children from their parents.
Errol Morris, Jacob Soboroff, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Let's start with the meat of this. Errol, can you talk a bit about the zero tolerance policy that is, you know, the focus of this documentary?
Well, in case you haven't noticed, we live in a world of euphemisms. Rather than actually describe policies, people come up with a way of hiding the reality of what they're doing through language. Zero tolerance, which was a favorite of Jeff Sessions, then Attorney General of the United States, was people cross the border into the United States, just prosecute them to the full extent of the law. And as nasty, as draconian as immigration policies had been in previous administrations, this was a new step beyond what had been done before. And they all, or many of them in the Trump administration, echoed this sentiment. We're not doing anything new. We're not changing anything that has been done before in policy. We're just enforcing the law, or if you like, zero tolerance. But there's a lot that could be said about this.
Well, you know, Trump is both euphemistic, but also he's very blunt speaking. And he talked openly about family separation, right? That was the point of the policy, because that's how it would work as a deterrent. So in that sense, he was being pretty upfront, at least once this policy came into full view.
Maybe. I actually, quite recently, decided that this whole issue of deterrence was a deflection from the reality of what was going on. I currently believe that Trump was doing this for his base. It was a way of advertising toughness, cruelty, that it wasn't for immigrants at all. It wasn't designed to deter anything. It was designed to promote him to his followers. And if anything we've learned in the last 10 years, maybe we've learned it through the entire history of our country, is that racism sells. It sells big time. I've watched an election just filled with racism. And this is just one example of it. I think it's a particularly horrific example, but it's not unique.
Jacob, the documentary is based on your book about this policy and your reporting that was happening as it was going on. To touch a little bit on this question of euphemism, misdirection, this policy started in the fall of 2017, but then it only became public or fully public in 2018. Walk us through what was going on in the early stages, and how did people in the government talk about it amongst themselves and to the public?
Family separation was always a policy that was under consideration in the Trump administration from the get-go, and that's because it had been proposed during the Obama administration. And just to go back to what Errol was saying a moment ago about deterrence, I think both things are true. I think what Donald Trump realized is that a deterrence-based system that allowed family separation to be proposed under Obama, even though it was rejected, and that actually goes back to Bill Clinton, who had this policy prevention through deterrence, built the first wave of border walls, George W. Bush, exponentially increased the size of the Border Patrol, Barack Obama, as you know, Nick, deported more people than any president in the history of the United States of America. And then Trump, like that, is able to separate 5,500 children from their parents. Donald Trump realized this deterrence-based system is set up in such a way that it is advantageous to play to my base by doing something more extreme than any president had ever done in terms of deterrence. And politically, I think Errol's right. It worked out for him, and it has again in this election. During the Obama administration, the same cast of characters, including Tom Homan, who's coming back as now the incoming border czar and was the acting ICE director during family separation, was part of the team that proposed family separation. And while other deterrence-based policies were certainly used under the Obama administration, like a massive deportation program, they rejected family separation. But as early as Valentine's Day 2018, in a meeting that Errol documents brilliantly in the film, in the Ronald Reagan building in Washington, D.C., many of these people assembled again. And they talked about implementing this family separation policy, and essentially they hit the ground running. And from the very earliest days of the Trump administration, even in 2017, they secretly developed a pilot program out of the El Paso sector of the Border Patrol that Lomi Creel at the Houston Chronicle actually uncovered in real time, although none of us really knew what it was back then. And only in 2018 did they sort of announce this to the world that they had been doing this and now it was going to become official government policy.
Can I ask about that? Did they not announce it earlier because they were afraid of backlash or because they hadn't perfected it yet?
I think a combination of both. You'll see emails in the Microsoft Outlook has never looked so great on the big screen as it does in Errol Morris is separated. You see these emails, including ones from press officials within the Department of Homeland Security talking about exactly what you just said, Nick, which is there is going to be blowback once this comes into the press from the American public, from stakeholders that are involved. It's right there in plain English on the screen. They knew it. I also think they were looking to figure out in their mind if it worked, and what worked means is there are several different definitions. Is it going to stop people from coming? No is the answer. Deterrence never does. Punishment never does. And will it have the intended effect of scaring Congress into perhaps enacting more restrictive immigration laws, which is exactly what I think, and from the policy perspective, the goal of family separation was, which was to tighten the screws in terms of deterrence and punishment and cruelty, as Adam Serwer coined in The Atlantic. The cruelty was the point of all of this.
Errol, one of the most electrifying is the wrong word, kind of revolting dynamics in the documentary is when you're talking to various people who were involved in implementing this policy or whatever. I mean, a lot of them are like, no, it became one of those things where like nobody really knew why this was happening or where it was coming from. Is that, Is that just simply cover your ass type stuff for people now looking backwards? Or do you have a sense that there was this kind of fog machine going on where, you know, directives to say, okay, start doing this, separating underage children and their parents as they're crossing the border, but, you know, don't ever take full responsibility for it?
I lean in the direction of the latter, the fog machine explanation. We see Kelly, who is director of Homeland Security and then chief of staff for Donald Trump in the opening months of his administration. We see him saying he could not imagine a situation where children would be separated from their parents. So, given that this was actually going on in this El Paso program as he was testifying before Congress, you know, I'm left with alternatives: that Kelly is knowingly lying, misrepresenting something that he knows is happening, or else the government never shared with him the extent of their own policies. Part of my movie is a story about bureaucracies and how bureaucracy works or doesn't work. And the feeling that I have is that people were given various kinds of marching orders, but a lot of this was directed from the White House and from the Department of Justice. The Millers, the Sessions, were orchestrating a policy that perhaps wasn't shared with everybody in the government.
If I could, what you see, Nick, what Errol lays out so beautifully is that, and Jonathan White, this career official within the Office of Refugee Resettlement that attempted to stop the policy, says it very plainly. What was going on was that junior non-Senate confirmed political appointees, namely Scott Lloyd, the director of the Office of Refugee Resettlement, political appointee, with virtually no refugee resettlement experience to his name before he got the position, were in direct contact with senior presidential advisors.
They got the virtually no, none.
Yeah, that's right. I stand corrected. He was in direct contact with Stephen Miller in the White House. And I think, just to pause for a moment, we cannot underline enough how unusual that is. A senior advisor to the president talking to a low-level, non-Senate confirmed political appointee within the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which is so far down deep in the Health and Human Services Department. It's not just some sub-agency of HHS. It's under the Administration for Children and Families, and then it's the Office of Refugee Resettlement. And this guy, who was completely inexperienced in terms of working with these career officials, was talking to Stephen Miller. Again, you can see it plainly in the emails on the screen and separate it.
You know, walk through, Jacob, the process of, you know, a group of people trying to enter the U.S. come to the border, you know, and it's a couple of adults and some children. What happened to them under this program?
The idea is, normally, under international law, you come to the United States, whether at a port of entry, and you encounter Customs and Border Protection officials, the folks that wear the blue uniforms, or you do so between ports of entry and encounter the Border Patrol, the folks in the green uniforms, you can express to them they wish to declare asylum under international law. And many families were coming to the United States to do that. And is there a conversation to be had about, is the asylum system broken? Is everybody that comes and declares asylum actually eligible, and should they be granted it? Of course, there's a conversation to be had about that. But instead of having that conversation, what the Trump administration did under the euphemism of ending catch and release is, when these people came from all types of places, but mostly from the Northern Triangle countries of Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador, got to the borderline, were seeking out a Border Patrol agent and said, I want to declare asylum, they'd be brought to these detention centers, essentially holding cells along the border, and ripped apart from their children deliberately. The kid would be rendered unaccompanied and sent to the Office of Refugee Resettlement, to these shelters, you know, giving air quotes, because what they were really doing was incarcerating children who didn't arrive unaccompanied, who shouldn't have been put into the system, but were forced there, and taking the parents and putting them into ICE detention, then prosecuting them. Some of them went to federal prison, and many of them, well over 1,000, there's still 1,360 cases without confirmed reunifications today, 6 years after this policy started, and they were deported back to their home country without their children.
Errol,
state-created orphans.
Right. And, you know, as is, you know, clear, in many cases, or in some cases, the cages or the fenced, you know, places that the kids were sent to had been built by the previous administration.
Errol, about it.
Yeah. Talk a little bit about this, because I want to talk about this in the broader context of immigration. You know, Bill Clinton, in 1996, when he was running for reelection, he made illegal immigration, you know, a cornerstone of his second term. What's the through line with immigration for you in American history? I mean, there's, you know, we simultaneously, you know, proclaim ourselves a nation of immigrants. I suspect by that all of our last names and personal histories within two or three generations, that's when our first American ancestors showed up. On the one hand, we're a nation of immigrant. On another hand, you know, on the other hand, at any given point, large majorities of Americans say that immigration is a problem. Can you talk about this dynamic, Errol?
It's really hard to know what to say. As you have pointed out, we're a nation of immigrants. My family comes from Eastern Europe. I'm a Jew, an American Jew. But if we had stayed in Eastern Europe, we would have been destroyed by the Nazis. I wouldn't be here. No one says that there should be no immigration policies. No one says that there should be no borders. But there has to be some kind of policy based on reason and empathy, not on cruelty and punishment. I've watched an election where there have been so many appeals by Trump and Vance to racist ideology. I'm shocked. I like to think of America as being a different kind of country. And perhaps the nadir of all of it was listening to Vance describe these claims about Haitians eating pets in Springfield, Ohio, saying, well, even if it isn't true, it calls attention to an underlying problem. Even if it isn't true, even if it isn't true, if it isn't true, you shouldn't be saying it. And all of these things make it possible to beat up on people, people of different races, people less people in disadvantageous situations. It allows for cruelty and allows for racism.
Jacob, what do you think is going on? Preparation for this, I looked at Gallup polling, which has been, you know, they ask Americans' attitudes towards immigration. And in, June of 2024, which are their most recent numbers, just 16% of Americans said they wanted the level of immigration, legal or illegal, this is just immigration, increased. 55% wanted it decreased. That's a recent high. The previous high was actually in 1995. When 62% of Americans wanted the level of immigration decreased. Why, and then, you know, these things peak and valley. Why do you think we're going through a sustained anti-immigration sentiment among Americans?
A couple things. What Errol just described, number one, is the incredibly effective messaging of the Trump campaign and J.D. Vance. Combined with the fact that the incoming Biden administration, after the family separation policy, and I should say incredibly effective but completely fact-free messaging of the Trump and Vance campaign, combined with what the Biden administration had promised after the family separation policy, which was a fair, safe, humane, orderly system. And that's not what American people saw during the last administration. They saw, you know, thousands of Haitian migrants under that bridge in Del Rio, you know, confronted by Border Patrol agents on horses. I went to Haiti and I watched those Haitians deported back to a country where very well they, you know, may face death going back there in record numbers. People didn't feel like a fair, safe, humane, orderly system was being implemented by the Biden administration. It was another system based on punishment and disorder that sort of permeated our consciousness. And so that allows immigrants to continue to be thought of and talked about as data points on a chart, as numbers of people crossing the border, rather than what we all saw with X-ray vision in the summer of 2018, because children were being tortured, in the words of Physicians for Human Rights, or subjected to government-sanctioned child abuse, according to the American Academy of Pediatrics, was a system that ripped the humanity out of little kids and out of our immigration system. And I do think that while the polls say people support mass deportation, when they see what mass deportation really is, which is just family separation supersized by another name, not ripping children from their parents at the border, but ripping parents from their children in the interior. You know, there's 20 million people in this country who live with an undocumented person in their household. It is going to be a different story and a different sentiment from the American public.
Before we continue with the recent interview, I want to tell you about today's sponsor, ZBiotics. This is a game-changing product that you can use before a night out. Do you think you need to make a choice between having a great night or a great next day? ZBiotics might make a huge difference for you. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in your gut. It's this byproduct, not dehydration, that's to blame for your rough next day. ZBiotics produces an enzyme that breaks this byproduct down. All you have to do is remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night and then drink responsibly. Try it out and see a difference the next day. I don't drink, but I'll tell you what, a friend of mine who does recently cracked open ZBiotics when we were out. And I said, hey, does it work? She told me, yes, it really works. Go to ZBiotics.com/TRI to get 15% off your first order. Use that code, ZBiotics.com/TRI at checkout. TRI stands for the recent interview. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money without asking any questions. Once again, head to ZBiotics.com/TRI, and you're going to get 15% off at checkout. Now, back to the recent interview.
Let's talk a little bit about how the zero tolerance family separation policy ended in the spring or summer of 2018. Part of it is because it became visible, right, Errol? What went into, you know, it provoked a backlash. Does that give you any hope for, this, if it gets implemented the second time around, that when people see this, it's going to change their attitudes?
It's hard to know. I think one of the reasons that both Jacob and I are doing this currently is the hope that we can prevent these policies from being implemented again. I don't know. People are credulous. People are malleable. If you have a candidate for the presidency of the United States repeatedly telling us that all immigrants are rapists, criminals, and
drug dealers.
Drug dealers.
Yeah. Some of them, Trump famously said in 2015 when he was talking about Mexicans coming, some of them are okay, right? He guessed.
I heard very little of that in this current presidential campaign. It had turned hyperbolic and nasty. Can that be true?
Yeah.
Be true that all those people that are looking for a better life, that are coming across the border hoping for something better, can all of these people just be miscreants, criminals, villains? I think not.
Yeah, Jacob, here, let's do this. Going back to the, you know, Springfield, Ohio, the site of cat-eating Haitians, which at a certain point, J.D. Vance acknowledged that he didn't know if these charges were true, but he thought he should call attention to them. And he's kind of stopped talking about it. When you read stories about Springfield, I myself lived in kind of rural or small town Ohio for a long period of time, and I know Springfield, and I know that it is a town that was down on its luck, and that it basically brought in the Haitians who are there are under temporary protected status, so they're there legally, and they were working, you know, and they were doing jobs that were not being filled by other people, but you know, to steel man this, we have a large parts of the country. Where people feel as if they've been left out of any forward momentum that's going on. And then they see a bunch of people who look different than them, speak different than them, might have different, you know, kind of everyday habits. How do you speak to people who, you know, feel like they are the forgotten man? And that, you know, while their life prospects are dwindling, other people are coming in, and you know most of this is baloney. But you know, where not only are people being flown into the country, but then they're given jobs and EBT cards and things like that. How do you address that kind of dynamic, which seems to be, you know, undergirding a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment or rhetoric?
I think people have been convinced that they should be upset by seeing people who are different from them come into this country. At least a subset of sort of the American public that consumes this type of political partisan media. And it's just not the reality. And I think that, as I said, these are our neighbors and our coworkers and our friends. I mean, when you really look deeper, one of my favorite pieces of media that I consumed when all this craziness was going on in Springfield was a PBS NewsHour report in which a journalist went into one of the factories and said, "This place hasn't been the same in a great way since the Haitians came in to this community. They have made this community better. They have made this place of business operate in a way it hasn't in many years." I guess it's about looking at the facts on the ground, you know, and what they really are. And that's what happened during family separation as well. If you recall, during family separation, the narrative was these are fake families coming into the United States. They're not real mothers and children or fathers and sons crossing the border. They're phony. The cartels created them in order to...
The children are being trafficked for illicit purposes.
Right.
They aren't really families at all.
Yeah. And until you go in these places... Sorry, Eric, go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
And until you see it for yourself, you don't really understand that. And it's why... honestly, it's not my journalism. I'm glad to have been a part of it. I'm glad to have gone in this facility, to have the opportunity to bring in the little new blue notebook that you see in the film when I document this for myself. But there were dozens and dozens of journalists. I'll give you some of their names. Kaylin Dickerson, who won a Pulitzer Prize at The Atlantic for covering family separation. Lomi Creel, who I already mentioned, who was at the Houston Chronicle. Jean Guerrero, who documented some of the first separations down at the border for KPBS. The list goes on and on and on. Were it not for those folks, family separation and what was really going on would not have come out to the public consciousness and not created the biggest policy reversal, if not the only major policy reversal of the first Trump administration, because this all what was really happening came to light. And what I'm saying about Springfield, what I'm saying about the moment today is, what is there to be afraid of, actually? When you look around and you see and you meet and you talk to people based on their humanity, and the answer, I think, is very little. It's just a matter of overcoming these narratives that we are being fed, that a subset of the population is being fed about who these immigrants, who we all once were, as you pointed out, Nick, really are.
Yeah. You know, for the second Trump term, there's a lot of familiar faces. I want to go through some of them. He's already come up, Tom Homan, who has been named by Trump to be the director of ICE. Errol, what is your sense?
Well, he was director of ICE. He's been.
It's the borders more now.
I always thought this was a democracy. It's only recently that I know that we have czars in this country.
Yeah. Well, you know, that phrase actually, I think, came into being in the 1920s. So, you know, it seems very misplaced in an American context. But what's your take on Tom Homan? You show footage at the end of the documentary of him from the CPAC meeting in 2023. And, you know, in his recent comments, he is, if anything, he is more hardened on the idea of family separation than ever. Explain who he is and what you expect from him.
Well, I came very close to interviewing him. I can't list all of the people that I tried to interview and failed. Kirsten Nielsen being one prominent example. Tom Homan made it all the way to a studio where he was scheduled to be interviewed by me and chickened out. Never had anything quite like that happen to me before. He's in the green room, he's waiting to go on, and then suddenly gets cold feet.
Was there anything, was he watching your Steve Bannon documentary or the Donald Rumsfeld one? Or
I didn't,
what did anything precipitate that?
I don't know.
But can I ask Errol? Nick, can I ask Errol? Because I wasn't there that day. And just to be really clear about what happens on an Errol Morris set, this is not, you know, here I am in the NBC News Bureau in LA where we walk into the studio over there and we sit in front of the camera and we just fire it up. There are dozens of people. You know, I sat in front of Errol and the Interatron in this movie. This is a no joke operation. Dozens of people. I can't imagine the amount of resources invested into setting up a studio, you know, outside of Boston, because Errol normally works in and around Cambridge on any given day. To have everybody there and the resources marshaled and ready to go, and then Tom Homan show up, what did it feel like there that day? I have always wanted to be inside that room and in that moment when Tom Homan walked out, because nobody else showed up and left. If they decided not to do it, it was well before they walked into the studio with Errol Morris. What happened?
You know, don't know. I guess the tough guy is not so tough.
Well, let's the other person who is back and in a higher position this time is Stephen Miller, who has been named Trump's deputy head of staff. He comes up in the documentary. He's clearly integral to how this policy ended up being formulated and implemented. What is driving him? Do either of you have a sense of that? He's relatively young. He gave at the pre-election Madison Square Garden rally that Trump held. He gave a talk which is stunning, and filled with America must be made safe for Americans kind of rhetoric that, you know, you tend not to hear that much. But Errol, do you have a read on Stephen Miller? Where is he coming from? He also did not sit for an interview.
I don't. Who knows what kinds of narrative these people tell themselves in order to justify their behavior? I've thought a lot about these various characters in the Trump administration, particularly Kirsten Nielsen.
Mm-hmm. Who replaced Kelly as Secretary of Homeland Security.
Yes.
Actually, she replaced Elaine Duke, who replaced Kelly. Elaine Duke was the acting secretary who wouldn't do the bidding of the family separation policy. As you'll see in the film, Elaine Duke is one person who does sit down with Errol. And I think actually we don't talk about her enough when we speak about this film, but she wouldn't implement the policy. And there, you know, you see officials say, well, she's just kicking the can down the road. We got more papers to push. Ain't happening. And then she was replaced with Kirsten Nielsen, right, who was willing to do this bidding.
Yeah. So what's your sense of Nielsen?
I like to think that she was replaced because she wasn't malleable enough and wasn't blonde enough.
Well, what's driving Nielsen, do you think? Or what drove Nielsen, do you think, Errol?
Is a question I always ask myself. I'm not doing this in your case, sir, so forgive me. I like to ask myself, is this person stupid? Is this person just obtuse? Are they playing as an obtuse person and they're not obtuse? Is it a strategy for presentation to the public? And these are questions that I ask myself repeatedly about Kirstjen Nielsen. Both Jacob and myself have had the experience in the course of doing this work, of doing what we consider to be really bad interviews. We were ashamed of ourselves. Jacob expressed his shame at the interview that he did with Kirstjen Nielsen. I expressed similar sentiments in the interview that I did with Scott Lloyd. Mm-hmm. And I thought this meant I should just hang it up, that I had lost any ability to interview anybody. And then it was edited by my editor, Stephen Hathaway, and I realized why this interview is extraordinary, and it's revealing in a way that I could not really have seen clearly at the time. Jacob told me that his interview with Kirstjen Nielsen was a terrible failure. He was embarrassed.
Awful.
I think the interview is great. And it's great because it reveals something unexpected. We all have this idea. This is something that I, is a pet peeve, I might add, that interviews are supposed to be adversarial. And they only work if we've backed someone up against a wall or pinned them to a board like some kind of entomologist. Not the case. Often things are revealed that are totally unexpected, and those are the most important things. Jacob suggests to Kirstjen Nielsen that this is a policy of deterrence. She immediately gets her back up. I can't believe you would talk to me like this. No, this is terrible. All we're doing is following the law. And at that moment, it's complicated. What am I thinking? I'm thinking this is a person who is also, aside from being dishonest to us, is being dishonest to herself. She's somehow malleable enough to convince herself that that's all that she's doing and that there is no other moral dimension to these policies. Well, that's a terrible, terrible error.
Yeah. Jacob, she is going to be replaced in Trump's second administration by Kristi Noem, the governor of South Dakota, who is very anti-immigrant, both legal and illegal, really. She, among
and
other things.
Let's not forget, and dog killer.
Yeah, that's
anti-dog. Also yeah, anti-dog.
Yeah, well, I guess she's anti some dogs, right?
Yeah,
just as an aside, I know somebody in publishing who said that she's written a series of campaign books over the years. Each proposal had that dog killing story in it, and everybody was like, "What is fucking wrong with you? Like, don't ever tell this story again." And she got it through. She got a publisher to publish it, and it seemed to have killed her career. I mean, it stopped her dead in the tracks. She might have been the vice presidential nominee, but she's
well,
back.
I mean,
who is Kristi Noem, and yeah, what do you think?
Well,
she is going to add to this mix.
No, I think your point is so well taken that someone who maybe whose career, you know, we thought was gone into the dustbin of history, is now in a position to sign a decision memo just like Kirstjen Nielsen did. To despite getting a pair of contradictory memos, knowing that family separation not only would violate numerous laws, but also the U.S. Constitution, she signed option 3 on the line anyway, effectuating this policy, making family separation. You know, she'd tell you it was a referral policy to refer people for prosecution, but it was a family separation policy, the official law of the land. The question I have is what type of decision memos will end up on Kristi Noem's desk? And what is she willing to sign? And I, of course, can't answer that question today, but I do know the power of the position of being S1 secretary, as the folks in the immigration enforcement apparatus call her. And I think only time will tell what she will be able to do in that role.
What is the...
Sometimes call this the Dunning-Kruger administration. Dunning-Kruger wrote these papers, the sociologists, psychologists, who wrote papers about how if you were incompetent, you are invariably too incompetent to know how incompetent you are. The Dunning-Kruger effect. And we are seeing in the newspapers every day the list of these proposed cabinet appointees that's somewhat distressing. And if there's any criteria, for the most part, I'm not going to say that it's universal, but for the most part, we see people being appointed to positions that they have no expertise, and in many instances, they're diametrically opposed to the institutions that they have been selected to lead.
May not always be a bad thing, right? You might want somebody who hates the FBI to be in charge of the FBI, right?
Right or wrong? I don't think so.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, let me just, on that point, yeah. Nick, I do think it's an important one that it's not just Kristi Noem. Jalen Sulog, who's another character in this film, came to a screening of the film in Washington, D.C. a couple weeks ago. And, you know, Jonathan White is the career official central to the film and really to the story, you know, got a rousing ovation from the crowd. Jalen Sulog was on the panel with us after the film. And, you know, she said how difficult it is to be a career civil servant and have every administration, a different political appointee, come and take control over an agency that has care and custody of children, you know, with licensed professionals that are, you know, spent a lifetime learning about what it takes to care for kids. And then you have someone with a political background being put in on top. And you mentioned Kristi Noem, but Robert F. Kennedy Jr. will now run, if he's confirmed, Health and Human Services. Everybody's talking about the CDC and vaccinations and all that, but he'll also run the Office of Refugee Resettlement. He will also be in charge of the entity that cares for migrant children within this country. What does he know about that? What does Pam Bondi know about immigration and immigration enforcement now that she'll be taking over the Department of Justice, also responsible for the family separation policy, a driving force if you look at the Inspector General report that they put out?
Yeah, well, we can expect that when you know, the kids are sent back home under Robert Kennedy, at least they won't have had seed oils, right, in custody.
It sounds crazy, but what type of things will be put into place in these agencies by these political appointees that are their personal pet projects? Scott Lloyd, who is the Trump administration political appointee that Errol interviews in the film that we've talked about quite a bit, had no refugee resettlement experience, and in fact was an anti-abortion activist before he went into the government. And his pet project was tracking women who were pregnant and their menstrual cycles before the family separation policy unfolded. That was what his concern was. It's why Jonathan White resigned from ORR before the family separation policy fully went into place. Those are the types of things that political appointees with no experience bring and can do to these agencies.
Yeah, I'll say this from a libertarian perspective. It's a mix, because you don't get change if you don't bring in different people, but you also have to insist on expertise and competency. So it's a difficult needle
to thread. And a respect for the career officials who have done this for a lifetime. Yeah, I too see the benefit of bringing people with outside experience and other expertise into these agencies. But when it comes into such stark contrast with not just career officials, but experts in their fields, is when you get a family separation policy.
Right. No, and it's also on a more macro level, if people don't know what they're dealing with, if they don't know what they're overseeing, they get rolled by the status quo in various ways.
Scott Lloyd told Aaron Morris in this film, he wanted to sit, essentially be a backbencher in meetings and watch things unfold. And instead, he became the legal custodian and ultimately was complicit in the words of Jonathan White. Jonathan White calls him the most prolific child abuser in modern American history. He became responsible for the separation because he was responsible for those children, of all 5,500 children that will now have a lifetime of trauma.
As a final question, let's zoom out a little bit. In the 1980 election, there is a famous clip of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush, both of whom were pretty positive towards immigrants and actually had policies that ended up naturalizing a lot of illegal immigrants. But in a presidential debate in Houston, they argued over which one would be more welcoming to illegal immigrants already in America, because these people were a, you know, an absolutely central part of the American labor force and our culture and our society. It is like watching, you know, a film from The Man in the High Castle. It's from an absolutely alternative timeline that is, you know, in our lifetime. How do we get back to an America that, you know, we need policies. We need policies that are predictable and make sense and work and, you know, can be done on immigration. Nobody's talking about extinguishing borders and things like that. But, you know, could you each spend a couple of seconds of how do we get back to a place where immigrants are not seen as, you know, enemies of America, but rather, you know, kind of the thing that we are?
I think what both Jacob and I are doing are trying to call attention to the excesses of these policies and our genuine rational fear that it's going to get worse under this upcoming administration. I myself feel we need to weigh in. The only way to get back to a more rational America is to provide rational or at least semi-rational voices offer an alternative position. And I wish that we were all more like Jonathan White. Jonathan White is a man, I believe, of enormous integrity and principle. I'd like to be more like him. And if I can do some small job in making a film calling attention to these problems, at least I've contributed something to the Commonwealth. I hope so.
Thank you. Jacob?
Hear, hear. And the reason that I'm so proud of this project with Errol is that we both shared questions after seeing this separation policy. It's why I wrote the book, and I think it's why Errol decided to make this film. About how the U.S. government could do something so deliberately cruel and so haphazardly implemented. In other words, how could we have come so far afield from what you described in the decade that I was born? And I think that this film, in large part, answers that question, how we could get to a moment like the family separation policy. And I think just the mere fact that Errol Morris has made this film and tells the story in a way that only Errol Morris can is my answer to your question. It's that we need more of this. We need more Errol Morris storytelling, Errol Morris-like storytelling in this vein so that people can understand how a policy like this could come to pass, how immigrants could be so dehumanized, how we could let this happen in all of our names. And this is only the latest chapter in American history. The Republican appointed judge that stopped this called it one of the most shameful chapters in the history of our country. This is only the latest. And I hope it's not generations and decades before the American public can reflect on it like it was with Native American genocide or Japanese internment or slavery or the turning around of the Jews on the St. Louis back to the Holocaust. I hope that we can reckon with this right now. And that's why I'm proud to be a part of this project with Errol.
Well, we know that some bad things are going to be happening. This term, doesn't seem so innocuous to me, but mass deportations, what in hell is that going to be? And what is that going to look like? Yeah. And how can we rail and fight against it?
Yeah, thank you. Hopefully the fact that according to Gallup, 64% of Americans still agree that immigration is a good thing, that may help provide a hedge against the worst excesses. Errol Morris, Jacob Soboroff, the film is Separated. It's appearing on MSNBC. Thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you.